You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. We're joined today by Sue Gordon, who was until recently the Principal Deputy Director of National Intelligence, a position she began in August of 2017. Prior to that, she was the Deputy Director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency from 2015 to 2017. And before this, she served for 27 years at the CIA, rising to senior executive positions in each of the agencies at that time, four directorates, operations analysis, science and technology, and support. During her time at CIA, Sue served as the director of the Office of Advanced Analytic Tools, director of special activities and the director of science and technology, director for support, and ultimately in concurrent roles as director of the Information Operations Center and the CIA director senior advisor on cyber. Whew. And somehow she found time to raise kids and to marry the commissioner of the Gotham City Police Department. So welcome, Sue. Thank you for joining us here on Spycast. We've been wanting to have you for a long time, so we truly appreciate you taking the time.
I'm delighted.
So
man,
I've
had a great career.
There's a lot there.
How in the world did I lock into all that? That's craziness.
And you're not 97 years old, which, yeah. You know, that kind of resume, you'd think you'd be coming in here with a cane. Let me talk about the superhero origin story, to keep with the theme of Sue Gordon, because unlike a lot of the people we've talked to here before who have risen to the senior ranks, who were political science majors or who knew in junior high they loved traveling the world and wanted to learn more about the Middle East, you have a zoology degree and you are the power forward and captain of the Duke women's basketball team. That doesn't necessarily translate to immediately going into the CIA, which you did upon graduation. So what drew you to the agency? At a time in which it wasn't necessarily the high point of the agency's existence, the time when they're going through some turmoil, you know, with Stanfield Turner and others, what drew you to CIA as a job opportunity?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love origin stories, so way to go. So first thing, I'm the third child of a career naval officer. You know, we are who we began as, and so there's a piece of me that's just about public service, right? My parents gave me two pieces of advice. One was always do your best, and two, give something to the cause. So I think, first things first, I was predisposed to want to be of service. Second, my dad's bestie in the Navy was Stan Turner.
Okay. Well, that can help the cause.
I've known this forever. I mean, he and my dad were part of McNamara's systems analysis staff back in the 60s. So we'd known the Turners forever. And up until even when I was in college, Stan would come over and play tennis with my dad. And so he was a part of our life. I don't think I really processed him as the director of CIA, and he wasn't involved in me becoming the CIA, but the backdrop. I just joined the CIA because I couldn't decide whether I was going to be a lawyer or whether I was going to get my PhD or in zoology. And I thought, well, if that's your if that's what you're deciding between, you probably need to go get a job to figure it out. And CIA was recruiting on campus, and I thought, oh, CIA, Stan Turner, that'd be a good thing to do. Right. And I got the job, and I really thought I would just do what many people do, get a job and figure myself out. And it just took, and there were things about the agency that just were right for me. It's about action. It's about purpose. Something about intelligence really satisfied my fundamental curiosity that actually is makes sense when you think of a zoologist as a you know, when you're in life sciences, no one really knows. We're just all trying to figure it out. Right. So there's some symmetry there. So yeah, I just came to get a job, and then I didn't even get the job I was hired for. I was hired to be an analyst of Soviet biological warfare. So you didn't need to date me, I just did Soviet. And you're right about the timing. It was right at the time that Stan Turner riffed a bunch of people, and so my job went away. So when I got there, I'm 21 years old, I look 12, I'm all excited with my shiny new security clearance, and I walk in, they say you have 30 days to find work.
You really say you look 12, you're 6 feet tall, and you're just finished being the power forward on the Duke basketball team. Did you
okay,
start
at 6 feet? That was awesome.
Did you start in an intramural basketball league that you dominated at CIA with all the analyst nerds?
We did. I still, we did have a women's basketball team, and we did dominate all the analytic nerds. That's true. I'd forgotten that. 6 feet. My coach would have loved it. I might have been good if I was 6 feet tall. I'm tall enough. But no, I was young and naive, and so they gave me a little bit of time to find a job, and I did. And you know, the career you just mentioned, actually Jenny Rometty, the president of IBM, once said, "How in the world did you succeed? Like a degree in zoology and this," and she didn't mean it, I think, as awful as it just sounds when I said it. What I said is, think about what that means from the organization. I mean, think about an organization that would let someone's ability dictate their success more than their pedigree.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because your first job at CIA was as an analyst in the Office of Scientific and Weapons Research, and looking at, I believe, Soviet missile and space programs.
Yep.
You didn't learn this at Duke, right, in your zoology degree. and I would imagine that you mentioned this was Soviet focused. So this is tough. I mean, this is a lot of on-the-job training, I would assume, that you were getting when you arrived at Langley. And this had to be kind of learning as you go.
Yeah, so truth in advertising, my ZO degree was in biomechanics. So it was really the physics and engineering of living systems. So I had the same undergraduate education that a mechanical engineer or physicist might have. They just, all the mechanical engineers and physicists listening just dropped over dead like hell you did.
The fact that you compared mechanical engineers to physicists made them all drop over dead.
So I had good science and math. And truthfully, the first job wasn't massively demanding. It just required, a little bit of knowledge of how characteristics of performance translate into overall outcome. Where it really got interested was in my second job, when I became an analyst of communications satellites. And that one, upon getting it, I had immediate buyer's remorse. I'm like, oh my God, what have I just done? And I went to my boss and I'm like, are you sure you hired the right person? And he yelled at me, he said, who do you think you are judging whether I hired the right person? And I thought, well, that's adorable, but I better go learn something. So I went to some of our private sector partners, and I said, will you teach me about communications and communication satellites? And they did. And if we talk later about one of the reasons why I'm so into public-private partnership is, from my very earliest days, the patriotism and willingness of our industrial partners to partner with us and to give to us even when there's nothing in it. So Dave Henson, I still remember his name, I hope he's listened to this at some point, was an ESL engineer who took time from his day to just teach this kid who knew undergraduate calculus and and a little bit about physics, about how to think about satellites. So for anyone who's listening, the cool thing is you're not stuck with the knowledge you have.
Right. Unless you have an English major or a philosophy major, and then you're and you're in trouble. Yeah.
Okay. We can talk about choices later.
Right. Well, let me ask you a big picture question, and yeah. I think that this is interesting. You know, when you look at your career, you went from the Soviet Union as the main adversary, mm-hmm. and that was for a little less than a decade of your career, to looking at asymmetrical threats in the mm-hmm. 1990s, because you did work counterproliferation for mm-hmm. a time, to the war on terror and mm-hmm. Quine theory and now we're back to great power adversaries mm-hmm. at the very end of your career, where you're talking about China and Russia mm-hmm. and North Korea and Iran popping back up. Was this obvious to you as you went through, as this shifted, as the mission parameters changed over time? Was this something that you're like, okay, now we're shifting our way of thinking? Or was this something that you just kind of did like you did every other day at the job, is kind of adapt to whatever's in front of you?
I think I've always had my head up. I don't mean that in a career positioning way, but, you know, work really hard at the thing you're doing, but then try and figure out what the heck does it mean and where is it going. It doesn't mean I predicted it, but I do think that the change for me always was an opportunity to say, okay, what does that mean now? And what does that mean now? I think it's a really interesting question. Certainly what I saw was, you know, a Cold War Soviet dominant, where I saw us develop some of the most eye-watering capabilities that were designed to go after information that governments held. We were the only ones that had that information, and the people who were serving were really the warfighters and the policymakers. I mean, those were the people who were really informed. And then I got to see the global war on terror, where now the individuals hold the information. Those systems that we had collecting information about governments were not the ones that were going to work. And you really see us, the rise of our cyber and communications capability, mm-hmm. because not because we necessarily saw it coming, but because that's where it was. And one of the things that I think intelligence is really good at it is it's unbiased, right? Whatever is where we must be.
Right.
So I saw that come. And now we're in a third one where I think the threats are to and through information. And if we had to change our theory of collection and who our customers were from Cold War to Global War on Terror, because Global War on Terror wasn't just the policymakers and the warfighters. Well, now it was state and local, because that's where the threats were manifest. And now it wasn't just our Five Eyes partners. It was actually all the people. And so we really got more expansive. Well, now look at the world where the threats are to and through information, and the boundaries mean that, oh, man, I really got to work with the private sector. Mm-hmm. And the populace is directly involved. And because we're so digitally connected, the notion of partnership is even more expansive. So I think we've done all those things. And I think I've seen the community respond to it. The one challenge I think we've had is a little bit of Kodak's problem when they were a first investor in digital, but they couldn't commit to it. I think the challenge that I see us with now is, man, how do I do all of that? And is the world now more of the information-based threat? And can I give up some of the Soviet threat that I'm still holding on to? And I think that's the challenge. But I think the intelligence community is better at responding to those things than some, because it is charged with not having an opinion about the goodness or badness, but rather dealing with what is.
Is there a new problem? I would argue that since 9/11, the intelligence community has been on the public's mind a lot more than ever had before. And you see this manifest in different ways. Certainly you see it in the reaction of the intelligence agencies themselves going on Twitter. And you know, being much more publicly facing.
Right.
I mean, in the last 20 years, we've seen the creation of things like the National Cryptologic Museum, right?
Right.
Publicly facing from an agency that was no such agency back in the 1980s. And is this, obviously, the agencies are trying to use this to their benefit, to try to keep the public informed. But do you almost need to be does PR become even more important, almost as like a fifth wheel of the intelligence agencies, because in a democracy, as they used to say back during the space race, no Bucks, no Buck Rogers, meaning that if the Congress is not behind the intelligence community, you're not going to get the money that you need to do your job. And if the people aren't behind it, Congress is not going to react the same way.
I don't think there's any putting the genie back in the bottle about having a conversation with the American people. I think there are two. One, just the world is so intransparent. The world knows so much information. The world puts so many things together that they're going. The world is having its own opinion, and you see it. And I think intelligence is not only just as important today as it's ever been, but projects as important. But it has to take account for there's a world that knows a whole bunch of stuff too. So how are you going to have the standing to say yes and? So one is just the world is more transparent. The second thing is I think we can't underestimate kind of the lesson we learned from Snowden. And just to put my marker down, there's nothing good about the choices that he made. They were for himself. They were not for goodness or anything like that. That said, we did learn lessons. And one of the lessons I think we learned was when it first came out, there were only one set of voices talking about what was happening, and we couldn't figure out how to talk about ourselves. So when we finally learned to get into the conversation, it was a little bit too late, but we learned that we have not, because we carry the American people's trust, we have an obligation to have a conversation with the American people. And so I think that transparency has paid remarkable dividends as we've moved through some of the electronic age. So I don't think we're going back.
Well, have we gone far enough? I mean, you look at the argument over the FISA warrants, you know, that the Republicans are bringing up now. Again, not to make this political, it just so happens. Mm-hmm. They're the ones bringing this up. And, you know, very quickly everyone's, well, FISA, the FISA courts are a joke. They rubber stamp everything because they don't quite understand the process. And same thing with metadata collection, right? Metadata collections argued on both sides, and I don't think people really understand what the hell they're arguing. Is there a need that goes beyond what the IC has done to maybe educate the American people about what some of these issues are without, you know, giving away secrets, obviously. But I think people would understand a lot more about the FISA court and be willing to trust in the FISA court if they understood the fact that when, you know, federal prosecutors or need a warrant, there's a huge process that goes into it.
And yeah.
The rubber stamp myth is a myth. It's not reality. Yeah. And it's so easy. I mean, Edward Snowden, like you mentioned, tweeted out several times, like the FISA is a rubber stamp, and people believe that.
Right. Yeah, I think, and it's so on the one level, we're like, well, we do have a conversation with the American people. We have oversight committees, and they have the ability to hear everything we do in amazing detail, and we're a representative republic, and so they're the representatives. And so on the one hand, we're like, we are telling the American people everything. But I think we're learning how to talk more about it. And I think you're making a great point, is what the American people, I think, are afraid of is, because, you know, we're a revolutionary people. You know, I think I'm big about human geography and culture. You know, we're still fighting against the British, and I'll be damned if the government is going to have power over me. So that's kind of who we are. And I think what they're afraid is a government that is intrusive into their life in a negative way. Well, we're not. We're a nation of laws, and those laws protect those. And it's not the technology. It's not the bureaucracies. It's the nation of laws. And the intelligence community pays attention to those. So I think explaining how their worst fears are not at all the way the system is a good thing. And I think we did some of that very well with the most recent 702 reauthorization. I think we have to keep doing it and explain there are all those safeguards, and it isn't cavalier. And I think we have to have the conversation until that trust gets reestablished. Right.
Is there room in the public sphere for active agency heads? I mean, we've now seen a lot of formers, the Michael Haydens of the world, the John Brennans, the Jim Clapper, and others. And yes, politics brought this out, but they've also, when they've strayed off of the political conversation, provided extraordinarily interesting information
to
the public. And they had been hamstrung for such a long time because they were heads of agencies or others, to be able to forget opinion, right? We don't want, just like the military, we don't want our political leaders and our intelligence leaders making statements about Republicans or Democrats or anything like that. But they can make strong statements on foreign policy. Like, you know, they can make strong statements on how the intelligence community works. Is there a place for that? Maybe it's through the ODNI.
Yeah.
Maybe you put someone in as an as a director, you know, of national intelligence that does give public briefings from time to time.
Yeah. So I think I tried to do it. I think Dan did it some. I know Paul Naksoni has done it. Gina not as much. So I think there is a place for it. But I also think this is one of the things that we as formers can do. I think it's an interesting question, and I've had this conversation before about, do you give up that ability to help that dialogue if, as a former, you start having an opinion on left or right? And I think probably one of the things that's happened over time is the hyper-partisanship that we're experiencing now. When you speak, you have to make sure that you don't put three words together that can be used for someone else's agenda. And the national security community, and I think this is whether the intelligence community or the military, is so dogmatically responsible. You know, we just don't want to... Listen, our information itself steals decision space from our leaders. We don't want to be out there confusing it. And I think the environment where every word you utter gets used to prove some point makes them a little loath. But I think this is where formers can help. And time will damp out.
Let me ask you, you served in different levels, certainly, within the agencies under, I guess, by my count, well, from Carter through Trump.
How many is that?
I don't know. It's at least, well, six, yeah.
Was it 39 to
45? Well, it'll be seven then. 39 to 45 is seven.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about presidents as consumers.
Yeah.
And you can kind of speak to this certainly in vague terms or broadly, or much more specific if you've got good stories you want to tell. I'm wondering if there are any particular nuances about different consumers that you could maybe make broad generalizations, or you can make, you know, this person was the best because X, or just I enjoyed dealing with this president as a consumer because they were questioning. I mean, everyone has different ways and viewpoints, and we've certainly heard about them before. But from your perspective, like, what did you think of as kind of the, you know, the first consumer?
Yeah. So because of my career, I probably didn't have as much direct interaction with every president that I did with this one, although I have done it periodically. I'll try this again because I'm brave. I think that every president I've served has three things in common. Four. And this is true. Every president, without equivocation, has wanted to serve America. I mean, you see it. And it's the reason why every president cares about intelligence, because they are looking for information to help them make good decisions for America. That doesn't mean that it's always easy, but that's one. Number two is every president is different. You know, we redo the format of our presentations to the president based on the president. We have done this over time. One of the coolest things, I'm sure, I don't know if you have a display on this. Do you have one on the PDB over time?
No, we'd love to have one if you have any idea.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing we hold most dear, because that's the most, that's the relationship that we hold closest,
right?
Because we are privileged to be in that conversation. But over time, what they would tell you is every president does it. Some presidents only wanted 3 points on a card.
Right.
Someone.
I know Obama was on an iPad, and he liked.
Yeah, and he was a thinker and a reader. I mean, he was a comfortable president for us because he was like us, and like, you know, oh my God, what a nerd! We can write for a nerd, and we can, and do those things, and it was comfortable for us. Every president has been vexed by us. We steal their decision space. On our best day and worst day, we bring information in that matters, and it many times it is inconvenient. And in the moment, no president likes inconvenient information.
Right.
That doesn't mean. And then the third thing that's the same, or fourth thing that's the same, I lost track of my numbers, is that many times they wish we could say things we can't.
Right.
Right, so when you talk about politicization, that's really the essence of politicization is you know that there is a policy that would really love to have something being true because, you know, it's much easier to say I had to do it than I decided to do it. And so we've stood strong against that forever. Some notable exceptions where we ran into trouble. But this president and every previous, you know, has that moment. But that's not a scary moment. That's just you understand that moment. You just have to believe in your craft. I think what's interesting about President Trump, and I've said this before, I'm a competitive person. So I actually thought he was kind of a fun brief because he was just different and thought differently and was challenging differently. And he made you come with your socks up. He has a different context for his policy, and so he has a different context for how he the information he brings to it and how he thinks of information. And so I think he's a challenging guy because of all those things, because of how much information is in the open. But fundamentally, probably his biggest difference is how economic he is in thinking, and it is a really economic world now. Probably even more so mm-hmm. when it was political military. But, you know, it is yet another puzzle for someone who likes puzzles,
right.
And that is how do you get your information heard?
Well, let me take the conversation the other direction, talk about consumers downward. And one thing I found interesting about one of your former jobs at NGA is that particularly geospatial intelligence versus some of the other INTs, that the consumer of intelligence is not necessarily a top-level policymaker. In many cases, it's the warfighter on the ground, brigade commanders all the way down to, you know, E5 tank commanders. How does this dynamic kind of shape what you did? In essence, this is about intelligence flowing downward versus upward.
Yeah, so I was really lucky to get the NGA job. So if you spent your career at the CIA, man, it's awesome. And I did so many things that I never would have wanted to leave in my head because we were so complete and we're the Central Intelligence Agency and we have reach and, my gosh, we're the pinnacle of all the universe, right? There's
right.
just kind of that. Man, when I went to NGA, three things happened. Number one is it's in the Department of Defense, so you're feeling combat support, right? The second is geospatial did go all the way to the war fighters. So some analytic products were mostly meant for policymakers mm-hmm. and up, but man, geospatial information, its greatest utility is oftentimes down. And so you feel the pressure to deliver for them and you design ways to get it there, sometimes which are antithetical with your desire to do some processing or metadata. And the last thing is combat support and geospatial combination of the two are more open. And so for me, it was, in addition to learning about the department in ways that I hadn't, in addition to learning about the urgency of intelligence all the way to the edge, which is, I think, really important now, and technologically we can do more of it. But it was also started me thinking about the value of our information when it is openly available and the kind of problems it can solve. And so that kind of pushed me into the things that I care about now is public-private partnership,
right.
Making information available to the decision makers who need it, who are not necessarily the ones who historically would have gotten classified information.
Right, well, that's the I want to go into that. And we'll talk about your time at CIA in a second. Let's stay on the NGA theme.
Okay.
Because there's been an explosion lately
right.
of non-governmental geospatial intelligence
right.
where you can get on websites run by companies and buy photos of North Korea, right? You know, some of the places that you would never be able to before because of the influx of commercial satellites, because of the sharing, that's the open source. Number one, how much does this benefit us as a country? And number two, how do we prevent the brain drain to these companies that, I mean, this was always a problem for CIA when you've got an NSA, where you've got basically right outside of the headquarters at Langley, you've got these contractors sitting there from Lockheed and Raytheon and everybody else paying three times as much. Yeah. Now you're seeing it now in the tech sector of intelligence where how do you keep somebody at NGA, even as a GS-15 Step 10, when someone's saying, I'll pay you $500,000 a year to come work for me.
So, man, I'll try and parse that. First thing, I think the explosion in commercial geospatial inspired Robert Cardillo to imagine a vision for NGA that was different from its past. And that, to me, was the first agency that thought, ooh, this is a changed world. We're going to have to be totally different. And so that's awesome. And it's actually what all of us need to be. Wait, us, them, whatever. Whatever one needs to be doing
it's
is
them now.
Yeah, whatever that is. Pronouns. I'm fluid with pronouns. You know, so the first things first is it is a fact. That fact is true for others, but especially for geospatial. So it's really cool that an agency is saying, man, how are we going to be different? And so you're starting to see some really interesting happenings with NRO now thinking about the inclusion of commercial data even differently than they have in the past. So that's number one. I love that under his leadership, we dealt with an explosive world. The second is, it is an interesting challenge because it used to be that in some of these disciplines, the best work was at the agencies. Now there is really good work going on, not only in the private sector, but at other agencies that used to have to depend on NGA. So, so NGA with DHS in hurricanes in 2013 would send people to DHS in order to help them with all the geospatial things. In the 14-15, NGA made its product available openly, so that was awesome. In the 17 hurricanes, you call up in DHS and say, hey, do you need our help? And they're like, no, we have our geospatial analysts, right? It's just, it's become a commodity. And that's exciting because it says, well, what is then the special thing that NGA does? And one of those things is, one, the craft of intelligence and how you put that together, and two, the foundations in earth science, because it's not always about the biology of GHS workforce. I think we can't deny that there are people that not only will want to move or be lured to move, but it could actually be in their best interest to move and to swim in that world and then come back. So I think...
Well, it could be the best interest of NGA, right? To have people boomerang back into the agency later
so
on.
So two things I would say. Number one is the national security tent is just getting bigger and bigger because there's so many things. So if a kid's coming out of school and they're in geospatial sciences, I'm not sure whether I care whether they come to NGA or whether they get into that ecosystem, they're going to serve it. I think it will drive changes in the personnel system that says we're going to have to, instead of people like me that have 40-year careers, you're going to move in and out, particularly if you have those disciplines. I think that's probably true in terms of mathematicians and cyber folks as well. I think we'll have to change our personnel system. But at the foundation, isn't it awesome that there are cool, you know, it's fundamentally governmental service to take things that developed at the taxpayer's expense and now make them serve society differently. And that's just really cool. Well,
let me ask you about another public-private partnership that's a little different. In 1998, while at CIA, you were very involved in the formation of InQtel, which is a private nonprofit company. Works very closely with CIA, for lack of a better term, to come up with really cool new things, right? That you know, has been, it's somewhat controversial to a degree that you have a private company that is doing almost exclusive business to CIA. But at the same time, innovation tends to come from that. What have you seen that as a success story? I mean,
Yeah. So I see it a little differently from you, how you described it. So in 1998, we were having a trouble getting completely into the innovation engine of America. If you think about the arc of public-private partnership, it kind of goes from FFRDCs in the 50s and 60s, where we attracted and held talent for our use. In the 60s and 70s, we had things like Skunk Works, where big defense industrial contract would do things for us, but we owned the intellectual property. And then what you saw is the rise of Silicon Valley, and we weren't getting access to those people, and it was really cool. And they weren't going to give up their intellectual property to us. So Incutel was really about how do we reach that part of the American innovation engine. So I got the chance to think about what it should be. And what it really was marrying of the best parts of both. One, the purpose in the pocket of the government, in this case the CIA, which does have harder problems to solve and a little bit longer time horizons. And the ideas that were coming out of Silicon Valley, unfortunately some of whom were being judged too early by their commercial viability. And the idea of Incutel was, could we make capital available through this nonprofit corporation to ideas that would solve our problems but might not live to be commercially viable, and could we make them live to be commercially viable? Commercial viability, right? So it wasn't give money, so it wasn't the CIA doing it, it was all decision making by this nonprofit independent agency that doesn't have a CIA board member, doesn't, the only control was through a contract. Two companies to make them be successful, and then if they existed, we would buy their products and services, but so would other people. That's awesome. And for you to say, well, no, it's just a really cool idea. I think if you looked at it, I think the private sector has probably benefited even more than the intelligence community has, because we still have a hard time with that whole transition valley of death. But there are some really cool things out there that have, you know, from the Palantirs to the Google Earths to the Topsy, which kind of turned into, you know, went the Twitter route. Some of the early players in AI. So I actually think it served its purpose of being that bridge of keeping new ideas around long enough that they could be commercially successful. And then in so doing, raise all boats because we didn't own it.
There's no issue. I mean, again, I'm not trying to argue with you. I'm just trying to throw in this idea.
It'll be fun.
There's no issue of the federal government, in this case, the CIA, essentially picking winners in Silicon Valley.
Oh, well, see, that was the thing.
Giving money to particular companies that, you know, are more liable to give you what you want.
It's not, right? So Incutel is a private entity with its own board of trustees, with its own CEO, and they make all the decisions. So interestingly enough, when I first was pitching it to Congress, they were like, what if it sucks? what if it fails? And I said, well, if it fails, we'll just not contract with them the next year. I said, but the problem is going to be on the day that they hit a winner that turns really successful, and you're going to raise that question. But the real issue is Incutel is a separate entity that makes its own decisions, and the only control is that contract. But it isn't in deciding on winners and losers.
Okay.
Well, with the exception of, would they help national security?
Right.
Right. So if you can't imagine that they're going to address a national security problem, but that's really different from being built for the problem.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Let me transition to talking about the way, the reason for an NQTEL in the first place, and that really looking back at science and technology at CIA. In the 50s, it was very easy for the S&T guys at the time, there would be a TSD or TSS to create the necessary technology for our human intelligence operatives in the field. That obviously changed pretty dramatically when you started needing more high-tech things, larger things. The CIA really has never, not necessarily ever, been seen as a scientific agency. It's not today NRO or NSA.
Settle down.
I was going to throw you. This is a layup. I was going to throw you a layup. So let me ask you about the importance of scientific development in intelligence as whole. So you can kind of talk about it from the ODNI perspective, and then really kind of the double-edged sword of S&T. The more science we have, the more technology. Obviously, the more tools that we have.
Yeah.
But also the more tools we have to pay attention to in our adversary, because they are developing their own science and technology that we have to pay attention to.
Yeah, so that's the rub, right? We'll go from the back out. Is intelligence really is about advantage, right? And it's an advantage for decision makers. And how do you provide advantage? Sometimes it's because you know more, can do different. Sometimes it's because you have a little bit of time advantage. And I think S&T has always been an element of strategic advantage for nation states, right? And early on, huge role in what we were able to do in order to provide that advantage, technological capability to go after information. I mean, fundamentally, if you think about our origins, we were the first people who could really see beyond the horizon, right? Because we threw stuff up in the air that could actually see beyond the horizon, and that was massive advantage. And that massive advantage stayed for a long time. What's interesting is the Space Force is because now we don't have, others are actually encroaching into that advantage, and so it's contested. So I think S&T will always, because intelligence is about advantage, S&T will always be a part of that. What's interesting is that science is fundamentally an open thing, right? You are good at science if you bring more ideas in there. And so that balance, I think, is ever more difficult to manage between those things that you want to do in the open because the foundation needs to exist and so in order to have it all. And at what point do you need to stop being as open about it and lock it down so that you have advantage is an interesting one. I think to go with my earlier theme on the transition, I think we now have questions on what's advantage in the data world. It's why it's so important that we look at artificial intelligence. It's because now advantage is going to come through data. It's so important that as a nation we figure out how to have trusted communications, because trusted communications is really important for free and open society. So there's some now when you look at advantage, you're going to say, okay, those are going to be the technologies you're going to see the intelligence community and the U.S. government, national security have to proffer.
So
I answer that?
No, absolutely. And so well that I'm going to shift off the topic.
Okay.
Because we know a lot about operations side. We know a lot about the analysis or intelligence side. We talked about S&T. You were the director of support at CIA. And when this pops in my head, I somewhat condescendingly think of this is the group that gets you plane tickets and make sure that you have what you need to go overseas. There's a whole lot more going on. And for the unlearned out there, and I'm probably one of, I know a little bit more, but not as much as I should, about the director of support. Can you give an elevator pitch about why it's so important to how CIA runs?
Well, first, Truth in Advertising, love that job. You know, I was on what you would have called the mission side of the house for a long time, and then Dave Petraeus came in to be director, and he asked me to be the director of support. You know, when my bosses asked me to do things, I give a cheery aye-aye and move on. I think he did it because he was an Army officer and understood the importance of logistics. And I came to understand that, too. So support at the CIA at that time was all IT. We moved that out under me. But IT, finance, logistics, security, facilities, support operations, human resources. I mean, think about that. And what I loved about it was it's massive. If you think about CIA's global footprint, it is all of that at range, done twice at least. Once in the way you can see it, and once in the ways that you can't. So what I came to see was it was an incredibly complex problem, affected by professionals of incredible craft who had a culture of service. And so they had the ethos of the CIA, which was, I can do anything. But they had the service mentality that didn't need to be at the forefront. Just some of the finest, best people. There is no CIA at distance without the director to support. And you want to know what a leader is? A leader is a 20-some-year-old GS-10 logistics officer who is able to build a base and a physical presence on red clay in less than a year. And they will then find themselves there, not only having established it and being the support for the whole thing, but when the base chief is out of town, they're acting base chief. And when the comms go down, then they're asking commo. It's just really remarkable. And I fell in love with it. And what I tried to do with my time was to have support officers know that they had craft that could influence decision making, and my operators know that if they involved them up front, they would make better decisions. But man, I love that job.
You know, logistically, you're the thing you're talking about with safe houses, you're talking about cars, everything. You're talking about, you know, you look at any kind of even spy pop culture, but also real world situations, half of what you're seeing is kind of logistical
support.
If you
go into some place, it's a support officer that's leading. When we go into Afghanistan right after 9/11, support goes into Afghanistan. I mean, the facilities that allow us to take a derecho and not lose any operations. I mean, you can see. I mean, if your audience could see me, I'm almost wistful about this job because of, like I say, the craft and the culture, really remarkable.
Well, and, you know, no one's going to make a movie about them. You know, they're kind of doing it.
Yeah.
Absolutely knowing that they're not going to get any praise for it.
Yeah. Total badasses.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about a little bit beyond that, about, you know, your role in diversity and inclusion at CIA, because this is something that you certainly take seriously, not just at CIA, but within the IC as a whole, that you take seriously. And I think that, you know, director of support or logistics used to be seen as kind of where you stuck the people, you know, who couldn't hack it as anything else. And I wonder why it's so important to you. And you did an interview with, I believe, NBC a couple of years ago when you were still at CIA. We told a story about an assignment in the field that involved physical exertion, and there was a suitcase. Can you tell that? It's so perfect for the old world CIA. And I want you to compare it a little bit today, if you remember the story.
I do. And I got in trouble for that because the guy I mentioned in the story called me up and said, "What the hell, Sue?" So, man, this was This was back in 83, where, I don't know, and this is so, one of the things I loved about the CIA days, it's so egalitarian, where if you can do it, you can do it. And there was an operation overseas that they were looking for technical people to go do something cool, and I'm like, well, I'm technical, I can do something cool. And so they selected this team of four of us, it turned out to be three of my best friends and me, to go do this, and it was in a remote location, and it was in reasonably physically demanding circumstance. We had to learn how to rock climb, and so we could, you know, rappel and do things around buildings. And we were on our final selection. It turned out I was the first woman that had ever done this. And we walk in the room, and this guy who was very scary, very ops officer, I mean, he was terrifying. And he looks at me and he said, pick up that suitcase. And I'm like, what? And he said, pick up that suitcase. And I picked it up. And it was heavy, right? It was about 15 pounds. He said, can you carry that up 10 flights of stairs? And I said, can I breathe hard? And I did. And I said, yeah, I can. And then that was it. And I said, well, you can ask. I'm not going to say his name this time. You can ask my buddy. And he said, no, he's a guy. And I'm like, what? Yeah, it was different. I consider myself lucky because I saw when I came into the CIA in my office of 780, there were maybe two or three professional women. And I don't know that I felt it, but it was certainly true. And the women role models were awesome and brilliant, but they were few. And they were not like me. They didn't have families, and they didn't have young kids. And so from professional standpoint, it was not unusual to have amazing women, but there weren't a lot of them, and they were different from you were.
Well, that's the thing, with work-life balance is something that women talk about in all careers.
Right.
You have to imagine at CIA, that's on steroids.
Right.
You know, where at any moment you might be sent to go rock climb and rappel. Right.
And I think it's one of the truths, and one of the real unfortunate things is too often women are judged by what they don't do, right? Mm-hmm. You know, oh, well, she didn't go to X or Y and Z if she didn't do that, notwithstanding that the system didn't choose her if she couldn't pick up the suitcase, rather than what they are. But I am really excited about what's going on now. If you look at even when I left the CIA, we were almost 50% on the senior leadership team. And your numbers can often be deceiving in terms of you'll have good female population, but they'll be, when you look at where they are marbled, they're not
like
marbled.
Like support, right? You know, and not in operations.
Right. They're not marbled. And even if they're in operations, they're in a different kind of job than the operators overseas. Now you're starting to see that equality. And what from the CIA right now is, what is it, of the seven top positions? Six are held by women. And I know that there are people that are like, no, this is like an awesome moment in our history. So, you know, if you've had my 40-year career, you've been surprised that it's still an issue that women do things, because you're like, really? Now, 40 years we've been doing it. But if 10 years ago or 5 years ago, it was okay that it was mostly men on a leadership team, when you can now have mostly women on a leadership team, you're like a minute away from it not mattering.
Right.
It's
so
awesome.
What's extraordinary
to
me as a historian is that when you have women on the leadership team, that means along the way, there weren't things that blocked women from getting the next step. Women were able to get into middle management.
Right.
Women were able to get into upper management. Women were not blocked or not discouraged from staying in until the very end. And would you say, I looked at that as starting kind of under Petraeus, but certainly under Brennan.
Yeah,
where
for sure.
You have people, I think, Avril Haines and Fran Moore and the ED and then of course Haspel and her all the people around her. I want to ask you about operations though, because
on one of the things that's awesome that I saw, because I'm a pretty equal opportunity diversity person, what I saw the coolest thing is when more women got into leadership position, what it lifted all boats, because what it did is it challenged the notion that good leaders all looked the same. And then once you had women who were so obviously looked different, you would have guys who were different kinds of leaders, who now were getting leadership positions. Right. So the benefit of just saying, oh my God, someone who looks really different can be just as effective, has a really great organizational effect. Okay, you were going to say.
No, looking at the numbers, and of course, they're still relatively classified, but you can get percentages of women in operations. It's still less than, it's probably around 40%.
Yeah, it's smaller.
And as you mentioned, even within operations, there are some more equal than others, right? Mm-hmm. To go back to Animal Farm, there are some that are case officers, recruiting officers. There's some people that are, you know, not doing that work. Is that kind of the next glass ceiling within CIA, within the whole IC, to kind of, that needs to be broken to allow women to do the jobs that, I mean, women in SAD, right? Which, for the Special Activities Division, which is the paramilitary branch of CIA, there are a lot of guys named Andy, or that's not their real name, but they walk around, and, I'm Andy, you're Andy, you know, this is Doug. There's not a lot of women in SAD, right? That is the next kind of glass ceiling. I mean, do you see that this change in leadership may bring with it kind of the end of this kind of apartheid within CIA?
Yeah, I hate to say that it's generational. Well, I don't think it's just CIA. If you think about where some disciplines draw from, it's only recently the women were rangers. So I think generationally it's moving that direction. You know, it wasn't too long ago that women in the military didn't have combat roles, and now they're in combat roles. So I think those things you're going to see moving along. I'm really proud. Two things. We are not where we still should be. Women still have a different experience. Too many women still feel like they are undervalued. You go into too many rooms at the mid-levels where it's not as balanced as you see at the top. So there's still distance to travel there. And again, I just have to say that making people choose between pursuing the job they love and being treated decently has no place anywhere. So I think we've gotten so much better at that, but we still have distance to travel. I think we're on a path. Like I said, I think you're starting to see so many signs that we're not very far away from leadership at any level being available to anyone. I think we still have to continue to make sure that we haven't made artificial requirements for jobs that were put there because the predecessors were someone who could satisfy that requirement for a job.
Well, let me ask you, you had to deal with the work-life balance issue.
Yep.
And you actually chose something that would today be considered somewhat controversial, I guess, is that you left to raise kids.
I did.
And that is obviously a decision that didn't slow you down because, you know, you got to the position that you're in now. But is a perfect world where you don't have to do that? Is it a perfect world where, or is it a perfect world where the men are expected to do that? Or, you know what I'm saying? Like, is there a way to satisfy that work-life balance to where you can be a woman at CIA, do the same career you would as if you were a man at CIA, and still have a family and still do the things that the men have enjoyed now for 70 years?
Yeah. Okay, so first things first. One of the things that got me was that no job I ever had was at that time conducive to an 8-hour workday. Or I'm half as smart, so I had to work twice as hard. You can choose which one of those things it is. And the way I had chosen to prosecute my jobs and the jobs I took, there was a point at which I couldn't keep cheating time and I had to make a decision. And there's no perfect time and there's no one thing. I did come back pretty committed to taking a hard look at what we were asking people to do. I mean, had we created artificially jobs, or had we set an artificial standard that I needed to see your face in order for me to think that you were doing it? I think it's still hard with overseas jobs. It's still hard with war zone jobs. But I think we're getting better at that. I think what we're getting better at is reducing the artificial barriers. There are some truths. And there are some jobs you can't take at certain times in your life. So I remember I came off a being the executive assistant to the number three at the CIA, and she was pretty demanding. And so I was working from about 5 in the morning till about 10 at night, and I had a 9 and 5-year-old at the time. And when I was leaving that job, I was asked to go down to the NSC as the National Intelligence Director. And I said, no, I can't. Right. Because there's just no way I could do both those jobs. So I think the organization is trying to eliminate the artificial requirements that limit participation. But I think there will always be jobs that require things that you're going to have to make a personal choice at. What I want to make it so is that when someone makes that personal choice, it isn't viewed as weakness, or you have now, you're now not loyal if you've done that. It doesn't mean there won't be consequence, but you just don't want to be judged as though you don't care enough to not do that. Exactly. And I think we're getting better.
Great. Well, I could talk to you for hours, but I want to ask you one last question, and I'll let you go. And this is kind of a big waxing philosophic question. You know, you don't necessarily need to answer this. There's no right answer to this. But is there anything you can point to that might redefine the mission of the IC in the next 10 to 20 years? We've had the global war on terror. You had the end of the Cold War. You had Vietnam. We're kind of looking at these benchmarks that are about every 15, 20 years or so. Is there some future threat you're most concerned about? Migration, climate, resources, rogue states, proliferation. What keeps Sue Gordon up at night, even though she doesn't have to worry about this stuff anymore?
Well, I think I've already mentioned one, and this is a world where the threats are 2 and 3 information. So if you're going to have advantage in that, we're going to have to really succeed in that. And I think that's going to require some really interesting work because, like I said, we're a nation of laws, and we have laws about privacy and laws about protection, and that crosses organizations and country boundaries. And we're going to have to figure out how we both can use the world's information and be true to our values. And so I think that's going to take a lot of time. And I think it's a little bit of race, because some of our adversaries and competitors do not feel the same limitations that free and open societies do. And so you've got this tussle between, oh my God, if I didn't care about privacy, I could just go nuts.
Right.
I need to be able to use the data in order to have advantage. So I think that's going to dominate for a while. I think we are going to see, and staying out of political controversy on climate change, but talk about the geopolitical effects of climate change. I think you're going to see that. We've always known that it was part of the ecosystem of economic threats, displaced persons, water rights, and those sorts of things. So I think that you're going to see the need for the analysis of that. You're going to start seeing the effects, and then you're going to want the national security apparatus to be looking at it and using some of the data. I am really hopeful about some of the new sensing capabilities that will help us be able to see that in ways that we couldn't see it before. But I think we've got our hands full with data for the foreseeable future.
With so much now focus on technology, so much focus on data or Massent or SIGINT, is it now the time where we can perhaps gain an advantage with going back to old-fashioned human intelligence collection? Is there now an advantage, because everyone has gone in the opposite direction, is there an advantage to be gained to going old school? I kind of think when the Russians went back to typewriters after Snowden's revelations, they're like, look, we're going to go old school, even though typewriters can still be.
Yeah, so I think, one, what's awesome about HUMINT is that it goes after the most important, the most characteristic important element of understanding future understanding is intent. Right? What are people intending to do, how they use it? And you can, and you see it play out in lots of ways. And I think what you're going to see is redoubling of the importance of it, but it has to be merged with the technical side, because human behavior affected in a digital environment is both more exposed and more elusive. And so I think you need it. I think you need the humans analytically. I think you need the critical thinking. I think you need the problem solving. But it does have to embrace technology, because that technology can help give that the same value in the past affected differently.
Well, Sue Gordon looking well-rested, happy, wearing jeans, not worrying about the job anymore. We really appreciate the time that you took today to talk to us, and we wish you the best of luck moving into the future, whatever the hell you decide to do.
Hey, keep on pressing on this one, just differently.
Awesome, Sue. Thank you so much.
You bet.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and want to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.